Life's Everyday Mystery Solved. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium.
As usual, we start with a bit of mental exercise to kind of put your brain in gear. I mean, the questions that I normally ask. And I will start with two of them. In 1701, physician Sir John Floyer commissioned horologist Sam Watson to make a watch that ran for exactly 1 minute. Why did he do this? If you know the answer, you give us a call at 514-790-0800. You can also text us at 514-800. The second question. And this is the one that I gave you some time to prepare because I actually promoted this morning on the trivia show. So those of you who were paying attention then hopefully did the work and you'll be able to come up with the answer. Here's the question. Around the year 1904, the Parke Davis Pharmaceutical Company began selling a local anesthetic called Codrenin. Codrenin. And this was very useful in nasal surgery because it also stopped bleeding. What two drugs were present in Codrenin? Again, 514-790-0800, or you can text us at 514-800. I'm Joe Schwartz, and I direct McGill University's Office for Science and Society, which is mandated to separate sense from nonsense, fact from myth, keep you up to date on what's happening in the world of science, and hopefully keep you out of the clutches of charlatans. Of course, I also sit here every Sunday afternoon for an hour, chatting with you, hoping to inform you and entertain you with a variety of topics, including the kind of questions that I ask. All right, let's get down to a story here. Heinrich Hoffmann, he contracted gonorrhea. Didn't know exactly what to do, but he heard that Dr. Theodor Morell, who had become a fashionable physician in Berlin, had been treating the rich and famous with vitamins, herbs, various animal gland extracts, and that he had an answer to gonorrhea. So Hoffmann sought him out. And apparently, he was satisfied with whatever treatment he received because he recommended Dr. Morell to his boss. Well, you know who his boss happened to be? It happened to be Adolf Hitler. Who was Hoffmann? Well, he was basically the Nazi Party's official photographer, and he was a trusted member of Hitler's inner circle. Hitler suffered from many problems, medical problems, including chronic intestinal problems. And he tried to get help from all kinds of doctors without any satisfaction. Well, when he heard that Hoffmann had been helped by Morell, he agreed to meet him. Morell treated him with a preparation called Mutaflor, M-U-T-A-F-L-O-R, Mutaflor. And this contained some live bacteria. It worked so well on the Nazi leader that he made Morell his personal physician. This was much to the dismay of many in his entourage, including Hermann Göring. Göring was the creator of the Gestapo. He was also the chief of the Luftwaffe. Heinrich Himmler, the main architect of the Holocaust. Well, Göring and Hitler dismissed Morell as a quack and an opportunist. Indeed, Morell had a less than stellar history, having falsely claimed to have studied under Ilya Mechnikov, who was awarded the 1908 Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology for his work on immunity. Morell had concocted the story that he had studied under Mechnikov to enhance his own reputation. Why? Because Mechnikov had garnered a great deal of fame after his discovery of a type of immune cell That cell had the ability to engulf and ingest harmful substances such as bacteria and dead or dying cells. These cells would be termed phagocytes, from the Greek phagein, meaning to eat, and cyte, denoting cell. In this particular context, Metchnikoff had studied microbes in the gut, and he theorized that the growth of disease-causing bacteria could be curbed by increasing the population of harmless ones. Why? Because bacteria in the gut compete for the same food supply. That basically is the remnants of what we eat, basically the fiber that we can't absorb that makes its way to the gut. So anyway, because of an increase in beneficial bacteria, the harmful ones would end up being starved and then gobbled up by phagocytes. Metchnikoff believed that lactic acid-producing bacteria, such as the ones found in sour milk, were the key to good health, and that they even attributed contributed to the supposed longevity of Bulgarian peasants. Why? Because those peasants ate yogurt, which was full of lactic acid-producing bacteria called lactobacilli. Metchnikoff himself drank sour milk every day. And by doing that, he laid the foundation for the use of what today we would call probiotics. That word comes from the Latin for life. What is it by definition? Well, probiotics are live microorganisms which, when administered in an adequate amount, confer some sort of health benefit to a host. The host, hopefully, people. Professor Alfred Nisle was an infectious disease specialist who was familiar with the work of Metchnikoff, and in 1917 managed to isolate a strain of E. coli bacteria from the feces of a soldier who was resistant to an epidemic of diarrhea. That epidemic was probably due to shigellosis caused by Shigella bacteria. Anyway, Nisle surmised that this particular strain of E. coli, which would be christened E. coli Nisle 1917, was a probiotic and that it had crowded out the Shigella bacteria. He introduced this into medical practice as Mutaflore. The claim was that Mutaflore would treat intestinal diseases, which it actually did with various degrees of efficacy. This is the substance that Morell administered to Hitler, apparently with success. Although Mutaflore may have been the first commercial probiotic, I mean, of course, people have been consuming foods produced through the controlled growth of microbes such as yeast and bacteria since antiquity. Such fermented foods with sauerkraut, miso, tempeh, kefir, kimchi, and yogurt being prime examples have long been deemed to be healthy due to their content of live bacteria. One of the best examples of the use of such live bacteria takes us back to the 1800s and the sanitarium, which had been built by Dr. John Harvey Kellogg in Battle Creek, Michigan. In fact, he coined the term sanitarium. Well, the rich and famous flocked to this sanitarium basically to be cured of diseases that they never had. But in any case, he was a big believer, Kellogg was, in so-called lactic ferment, in other words, yogurt. He was an early disciple of Metchnikoff and extolled the virtues of lactobacilli as a means of, quote, driving out poison-forming germs. He advocated the administration of yogurt, both orally and by means of enemas, quote, thus planting the protective germs where they are most needed and may render most effective service. I've been to Battle Creek, Michigan, and there's a museum there devoted to Kellogg. And the equipment that he used at the sanitarium to treat his patients, and included in that exhibit is the tub in which people would sit when they had a yogurt enema administered to them. Many other interesting devices there. And although Kellogg by many people is considered to be somewhat of a quack. Indeed, he believed that sexual activity was detrimental to health, and he originally developed the cereals, with which we have become familiar, as an anti-aphrodisiac food. But Kellogg was on the right track when it came to the bacteria, as current research shows. Since the 1990s, research into probiotics has exploded, with the composition of bacteria in the gut, the so-called microbiota, being linked with type 2 diabetes, hypertension, depression, Alzheimer's disease, colorectal cancer, obesity, and inflammatory bowel disease such as colitis. And that is what medical historians believe was the cause of Hitler's problems. So it is certainly conceivable that he could have been helped by Mutaflor. Anyway, there's a little bit more to this story that I will tell you. But first, we're going to take a break to see what is going on out there, or not going on out there, in the world of traffic. You're listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We'll be right back with a continuation of my story about the medications that were given to Hitler by his personal physician, Theodor Morell. Stay with us. Let me repeat my questions. In 1701, physician Sir John Floyer commissioned horologist Sam Watson to make a watch that ran for exactly 1 minute. Why did he do that? Give us a call at 514-790-0800 or text 514-800. The second question is, back in 1904, the Park Davis Pharmaceutical Company began selling a local anesthetic called Codrenin, C-O-D-R-E-N-I-N, that was particularly useful in nasal surgery because it also stopped bleeding. What two drugs were present in Codrenin? All right, get to work, Google if you like, and give us an answer. In the meantime, I want to finish my little story here about pharmaceutical treatment of Adolf Hitler. So as I said, he was treated by Dr. Theodor Morell successfully with an E. coli preparation for his gastric problems. And this made him a real devotee of Morell. He followed everything that Morell advised. And Hitler had all kinds of complaints, headaches, constant colds, insomnia. Today we know how he was treated because Morell kept meticulous records of his patient A, as he called him. Well, those records survived the war, and they have been thoroughly analyzed. Kind of scary. Between 1941 and 45, Morell administered 29 kinds of injections and 63 kinds of oral tablets and skin applications. They included codeine, cocaine, testosterone, sulfonamide, oxycodone, strychnine, belladonna, bile extracts, morphine, barbiturates, extracts of testicles, and Vitamultin, his special concoction of vitamins, which incidentally was produced by one of his companies. He became rich from the fame of treating Hitler. He started up many, many companies. When Hitler was injected with Vitamultin, he claimed to feel refreshed and invigorated. Himmler, who was suspicious of Morell, as I said earlier, secretly had one of these Vitamultin pills analyzed, and it turned out to contain methamphetamine. Now, of course, the Germans were no strangers to methamphetamine. It was very commonly given to German soldiers as Pervitin, but it seems it was also included in this preparation of Morell's called Vitamultin. So many of the drugs that were administered by Morell, the ones that I mentioned, can certainly have psychoactive effects. And they could have contributed to Hitler's increasing paranoia, his anxiety, and even perhaps to some of his poor military decisions. And one wonders how history may have been altered if Hitler had never met this doctor, never met Morell, had never been treated with Mutaflor, had never become such a faithful follower of everything that Morel prescribed. So who knows what would have happened and how much these drugs influenced his mental state. Incidentally, Mutaflor is still available today in Germany, and it is indicated for the treatment of ulcerative colitis, not surprising, chronic constipation, and diarrhea in newborns. As far as, you know, the treatment of Hitler goes, I think that while some of these drugs could have had some effect on his personality, I think any suggestion that the nightmare that he inflicted on the world was somehow caused by drugs, I think that that has to be totally dismissed. Hitler was just evil, that's all, and it it was not the result of the drugs. Okay, so that's the story of the medications that were used on the Führer. I think Kenneth is on the line with a question.
Hi, am I on now?
Yes.
Okay, the ancients built coliseums and amphitheaters. How, from a chemical point of view, how do you think they figured this out? That because there's only so much energy in molecules and electrons, how could they have it that their voice could be amplified like echoes and amphitheaters?
Well, you know, the ancients were no less smart than we are. They, of course, had less of a background in science, but that meant that they had to you know, figure out things quickly from scratch. And they were very aware of sound bouncing off of certain surfaces. I mean, you know, they were aware of echoes. And when these amphitheaters were constructed, they were basically scientifically constructed. They had studied small-scale models of these to show how sound was reflected. And they were mostly constructed of limestone, and limestone can reflect sound. So the seats were arranged in such a way that the sound was reflected properly through the whole audience. I mean, I don't know exactly in detail how they did this, but they were very knowledgeable about echoes and reflection of sound. In fact, I think that there's one, an amphitheater, I forget what the name is, it's in Greece somewhere, which is still regarded as an absolute wonder in the way that the acoustics were designed. So, you know, our ancestors were very, very clever people. Even though they did not have access to, you know, all of the knowledge that we now have.
I'd like to ask you one of your questions there.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say invent a clock that only ran for 1 minute?
Yes.
Was it to check the pulse or the 1 minute waltz?
It was to detect the pulse, exactly. Of course, they knew that the pulse was somehow related to health. I mean, they had been, you know, measuring the pulse since time immemorial, but they never really had a way to do this repeatedly scientifically, because although there were clocks and watches, they didn't have second hands. And so what Sir John Floyer did was he asked this watchmaker to make a watch that specifically would run for 1 minute, so that you would have, you know, a base way of measuring the pulse. And of course, measuring the pulse is something that doctors do all the time. But to really do it accurately goes back to 1701, and this particular physician. Very good. You got that question right. All right. Thank you. We still have the other question out there about codronin and what two drugs were involved. But now let me replace the question that was just answered by another one. According to a study by researchers at the University of Michigan, eating this common food shaves 36 minutes off a lifetime. What food is that? Okay, let me repeat. According to a study by researchers at the University of Michigan, eating this common food shaves 36 minutes off a lifetime. Looking to find out what that food is. And if you know, you give us a call at 514 790-0800. You can also text your questions and comments to 514-800. I did have a question from Nick about what a quantum chemist does. Well, what is a quantum? It is just basically a very, very tiny unit of energy, and comes in packets, which are called quanta. Anyway, it's difficult actually to describe what quantum chemistry is without having access to some visuals. But very often the term is just used in a nonsensical way. They just bandy the term quantum around in advertising in all kinds of crazy ways. Anyway, you are listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We're going to take a break, see what is on with the CTV news, and we will be right back.
Your source when you need answers. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
Do you look upon the universe with wonder in your eyes? Do you tingle with attention when you're taken by surprise? If a problem should perplex you, does it put your brain in gear? Then you're ready for adventure on the science front.
You know, just as we thought that we were climbing out of this dark hole, which is COVID-19, the lid starts to close. Why? Because this Delta variant has emerged, and it is more infectious than the original SARS-CoV-2 virus, and it's surging. Infection rates that were steadily dropping are increasing. So let me try to explain what is meant by a variant. You know that spike protein that you see in all the pictures of the virus? These little sort of knobs that you see on the surface. Well, that's the key to how this virus infects a cell. Analogy would be a key in a lock. If this spike protein fits a receptor on the surface of a cell, it unlocks it, and somehow by doing that, it gains entry into the cell where it can then replicate and go on to infect other cells. A virus cannot replicate outside of the body. It can only replicate inside a living cell. Now, every time this virus replicates, there's a chance of replacing one amino acid in its spike protein by another. That means that, you know, mistakes are possible. And this changes the way the protein can fold. And depending on the specific change, it can result in a key that either slips more easily into a lock or with greater difficulty. With the Delta variant, there are four significant changes or mutations along the chain of amino acids. And it turns out that these changes enhance entry into the cell. This means that the rate of replication increases, resulting in more viral particles in the blood. In other words, greater what we call viral load. This means that more virus is shed by an infected person, putting others at greater risk. Vaccination reduces the risk of variant formation because variants can only form in an infected person. It is more important than ever, therefore, to increase rates of vaccination. Unfortunately, in the US, this has turned out to be a political issue, as demonstrated by a classic plot that you can find if you just make a search on the internet. Which shows the way that counties voted and percent of total population vaccinated. And in red states, vaccination rates are clearly lower than in blue states. Decisions about vaccines should be based on science, not political affiliation. Although vaccinated people can still be infected, they do not develop serious symptoms. And as I have noted repeatedly over the last few weeks, unvaccinated people make up the majority of cases in hospitals, and that should be enough to scare anyone who is hesitant into getting that vaccine. You do not want to end up in the ICU. You certainly do not want to end up on a ventilator. Once someone is on a ventilator, the prognosis is not very good. All right, let's hit the lines. I think we have Sylvia on the line. Sylvia.
Oh,
Sylvia.
Yes.
Are you Hello? There? Yes.
Hello.
Yes, Sylvia.
Yes, I think I know the answer. It's hot dogs.
Yes, the answer is indeed hot dog. This was a rather interesting but curious study for University of Michigan, where they looked at a great deal of published information about all the foods that supposedly are dangerous for us and all the foods that are healthy for us. And they mashed all the data together in a very, very long paper. And they come up with a list of times that foods either add to our longevity or take away from it. And a hot dog supposedly takes 36 minutes off a lifetime. Now, according to those calculations, a burger, that takes off 10 minutes. Chicken wings, only 3.3. A vegetable pizza will cost you 1.4 minutes. And an apple pie gets you 1.4 minutes extra of lifetime. A peanut butter and jam sandwich gets you 30 extra minutes. Seafood, 10. Fruits, 10. Nuts and seeds, 20 extra minutes. Of course, it is obviously nonsensical to put an exact number of minutes to what a food does for you. But the value in this paper is that they have really taken all the evidence available into account, and basically, they come up with a diet that is not surprising. That is that it is mostly highly processed foods and animal products that, quote, will take minutes off your life. And it is vegetable products that will get you extra minutes. But of course, one should not take this too literally, it doesn't mean that you can never eat a hot dog. It might mean that if you're going to eat a hot dog, it might be a good idea to smother it with peanut butter, as foul as that sounds, because that hot dog will take off 36 minutes, but the peanut butter gets you an extra 30 minutes. So if you eat a hot dog with peanut butter, you're only losing about 6 minutes. Anyway, I will address this issue in much greater detail in a forthcoming Gazette column, because it does merit some attention. It's not total nonsense, but of course, ascribing such specific numbers to a diet really doesn't make any sense. But it is correct. So that is the hot dog was the answer to that question. Okay, since you got that right, here's another question that I'm going to throw your way. Think about this one. A balloon is seen on a hot day traveling horizontally well overhead. Now, this is a balloon that's got a basket on it in which there are people. So, do the occupants of the balloon feel any wind? All right, so picture this. You look up, you see a balloon, and it's traveling horizontally, of course, blown by the wind. Do the occupants of the balloon feel any of the wind? If you know the answer to that, you give us a call at 514-790-0800. Text is 514-800. Okay, I have a question here. Does COVID, does the virus live and grow in the nose and spread in the lungs? Yes, I mean, any cell where it can enter, it can replicate. And so those cells can be anywhere in our respiratory tract. And the fact is that every time that if you're infected and you exhale, you will be exhaling some virus. And someone who is close to you can inhale some of that virus. But of course, as soon as a breath leaves your mouth, everything contained in that breath starts to spread. So it depends on how far you are from someone, who is exhaling. I mean, I think that being outside is not a big risk, because I think that the moving air will very anything that comes out of your mouth is very quickly dissipated. But it's very difficult to give a concrete answer to this. You know, like how long would you have to be conversing with someone outdoors, and how far would you have to be to you know, ensure that you're safe? I mean, we can just make, you know, educated guesses in this, because they're just, you know, there's so many determinants of what is going on. I think it's a good general rule when you're inside shopping or whatever that you wear a mask. It does reduce the risk. Outside, I don't do it. It doesn't mean that the risk is zero, but I think it is close enough. But basically, we're just making educated guesses on all these things. All right, it is time to check traffic again, and after that, we'll be back. Hopefully, I will get an answer to the question that I raised, for which I gave you plenty of time, because I even mentioned it early this morning. So what are the two drugs present in codronin introduced in 1904? You're listening to the Dr. Joe Show.
Life's Everyday Mystery Solved. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
You know, any time that you mention vaccines, the scientifically illiterate worms crawl out of the woodwork. And one has done that, texting me that while I mentioned the benefits of vaccine, I never mentioned the tens of thousands that have died because of the vaccine. No, I don't mention that, because that is an absolute lie. Tens of thousands of people have not died from the vaccine. That is a lie, just like the big lie in the U.S. about the stolen election. And I suspect, you know, it comes from the same kind of people. So, no, tens of thousands of people have not died from the vaccine. And had they, that would be worldwide news. All right, let's go to Joanne. Joanne? No, Joanne. Let's try Jerry.
Hi, Dr. Joe.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether or not it could have been codeine and epinephrine.
Yes, it was codeine and epinephrine, or adrenaline, right?
Adrenaline, yeah.
Very good. So this takes us back to 1904, and indeed it was, what did you say it was?
Codeine?
No. Adrenaline is right, epinephrine,
yeah.
But the co,
yeah,
is not codeine. Try another co.
You got me.
Try a COC.
Oh, Coke? No, cocaine. No, I'm sorry.
Cocaine, of course, yes.
You needed anesthesia, of course.
It was cocaine, yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was back in the year 1900, the Japanese chemist Yokichi Takamine isolated a pure crystalline substance from the inside, from the medulla of the adrenal glands, and he called it adrenaline. But earlier than that, in 1893, a British physician, a general practitioner, George Oliver, had shown that extracts of the adrenaline gland increased blood pressure, they constricted blood vessels, and they enhanced the contractions of the heart. Of course, he had not purified anything. It was just a crude extract of the gland. And even earlier than that, way back, half a century earlier, Thomas Addison, a British doctor, found that a fatal condition that was characterized by anemia and general debility and feeble heart function, stomach irritability, and change in skin color was associated with diseased adrenal glands. When he did autopsies, he found that people who had died with these symptoms had shrunken adrenal glands. So anyway, but it was finally in 1900 that Takamine managed to isolate and make a crystalline form of adrenaline, which of course now is a mainstay of pharmaceuticals. It's used to reverse anaphylaxis, you know, when someone has an acute allergic attack. It is used after cardiac arrest. It is used to stop bleeding. Very often when someone has a bleeding ulcer, they will inject adrenaline to stop it. And it is very often combined with local anesthetics that dentists use. And this, of course, is to minimize bleeding when they're carrying out work in the mouth. And a dentist should always, you know, ask if someone is has any kind of heart disease issue, because injection of adrenaline, even in very small doses, could have an effect on that. So very good. Yeah, it was Codronin, marketed in 1904. That was a mixture of cocaine and adrenaline. And cocaine has use as a local anesthetic, especially in some surgeries that are carried out in the nose and in the eyes. And as you see here, it has a rather interesting history. Okay, now to the question that I had posed about the balloon. That if you see a balloon up overhead with some people in a basket underneath it, and that balloon is traveling with the wind, the question is, do the people in the balloon feel the wind? And no, the answer is they don't, because that balloon would be traveling at exactly the same speed as the wind. So they would not feel anything. If you want an analogy, it is like if you're driving a car and there's a car beside you that is going at exactly the same speed as you are doing, then your speed relative to the other car is zero, right? If you look out the window, it doesn't look like that car is moving at all because you're moving at the same speed. So no, in the balloon being carried by the wind, you would not feel the wind at all. Interesting little problem. I don't know if we have time to get in another question. Well, probably not. So let me see if there's any question that needs to be answered that's been texted in. Okay, it says, perhaps you can dispel the myth that vinegar and baking soda actually cleans or clogs anything. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I know that there are people who will pour down vinegar and baking soda down the drain when they feel that it has been clogged. Well, it might have some mild effect, because when you combine baking soda, which is sodium bicarbonate, with vinegar, which is acetic acid, of course you form carbon dioxide gas. And the carbon dioxide gas bubbles may be able to dislodge, you know, some clogs, but it would have to be a very loose clog, I think. You have a much better chance of dislodging it with a pump. So, no. Similarly, there's no real reason for cleaning that you would want to mix sodium bicarbonate with vinegar, because the only thing that does is neutralize the effect of each, right? Each of these, sodium bicarbonate or vinegar, individually are pretty good cleaning agents. Sodium bicarbonate, especially if you put it on a moist cloth, acts as an abrasive, and it also produces an alkaline solution. And alkaline solutions are quite effective at breaking down grease. So if you have some sort of, you know, greasy soil, yes, sodium bicarbonate will work on that. Now, vinegar, acetic acid, is also a good cleaning agent because so many substances dissolve in an acid. However, what happens if you take sodium bicarbonate and mix it with acetic acid? This is a classic neutralization reaction, one of the first reactions that students in school learn. And if you combine sodium bicarbonate and acetic acid, what you get is sodium acetate, which is ineffective as a cleaning agent, and you release carbon dioxide gas, which just goes off into the air. So independently, either baking soda or vinegar are good cleaning agents, but there's no reason to mix these together. Okay, we have once again run out of time. Let me just remind you that you can always check our website, which is www.mcgill.ca/OSS, where you can sign up for a free weekly newsletter. And also, if you want to get on my mailing list for my daily short 3-minute videos about current happenings in the world of science, shoot me an email. My email address is joe.schwarcz@mcgill.ca. And we will see you with more info and more fun a week from today. Until then, I'm Joe Schwartz, hoping that all the chemistry in your life comes out just right.